This fluid penetrates matter, and, with the assistance of the essence I speak of, can become so shaped that it is able to get in touch with the cell in the brain that is ready to respond. The will, with the assistance of these two elements, is able to join us by a thread the image, Tom Jones, to the cell. You have such perverted ideas of space, as long as you are in matter, that you cannot for a moment grasp how millions of little images made in this manner are all in touch with the millions of cells in the brain through these threads. Imagine an immense spider's web about you. All the strands bear memories or thoughts to the brain as the wires transmit telegraphic messages, and can carry to the brain messages, or, rather, the sign of the image that has been created through impress being made on something plastic with the assistance of this essence. Page 79 now. Your words make it impossible. You have no term, for instance, for this clay that receives the impression. I call it clay, but it is not of the nature of matter. This clay, as I call it for want of a better word, is the substance out of which thought is constructed. Of course, it is not substance as you understand it. Very well, then, this clay receives all the impressions your sight, hearing, and touch convey, but it does not make the connecting thread with the brain cell unless your will makes the conscious effort which is necessary for its construction. You now ask, what is will? Will is the energy that flows to you from the large individual mind without you, added, of course, to the collection of images that are all attached to the physical brain as I have already tried to indicate. The will is influenced by the physical body. The larger mind contains that infinite subtlety of atoms that are not destroyed through the death of that crude machine, the body. Actually, though I call them atoms, they would appear to you to be of a fluid character. I want you to realize, though, that the essential you is something that is composite as long as you are alive. It is an alliance between what is material and what you call immaterial. The body or matter has certain yearnings brought about by the actual nature of its construction. These are not you, but they dominate you, because they can usually command much of what is immaterial and can enter into the directive process that goes on in the cells of the brain. These cells are so highly sensitive that they can and do respond to the stimulus of a being who is motion rather than substance. Think of your will, then, as motion, ever by its active energy coalescing these images, marshalling them, causing the brain, which is the only part at all sensitive to pure motion, to draw upon the threads that are attached to these images when the need for their uprisal in the consciousness is made manifest. I have tried to explain what you cannot possibly conceive so long as you are in matter. Memory. Memory out of the body is a different affair altogether. When we become discarnate beings, we are far more detached from the earthly images for the reason that they are no longer bound to us by matter through the medium of the brain cells. The threads, as you must realize, are broken by death. It does not mean that these images of all the impressions ever made on you are destroyed, they still exist, but we, when we choose, can, under certain psychic conditions, draw those images we desire to us by making the effort of the will that places us amongst them. We do not draw them to us as when we are alive, with labor and difficulty. We simply make the necessary effort which places us in the state that makes it possible for us to perceive the images we desire. Now, we are not in that state when we communicate through you. That is our difficulty. We are quite detached from these images, and unless the medium has the psychic power of absorbing the facts demanded from our memory with our assistance, of course we cannot provide you with the evidence you require. The ordinary human being does not possess this particular power, which is a kind of overflow of the fluid which takes the shape of your body and is about you, though invisible. These images are outside the brain. They are outside the body, being connected by threads that are invisible to you because they pass through matter and are not themselves matter. They are amenable to touch certainly, but are not remembered unless a very considerable effort is made to draw in the appropriate thread and its image. Even then there are many images that cannot be drawn within their normal consciousness. I cannot find in the English language words sufficiently exact to make my meaning clear. Now, memory may be likened to the sea. It is all about you, and as elusive as the water of the ocean. When we are alive we come to it like children with our small buckets, and fill them with the salt fluid. How little we carry away up the sands. how easily and swiftly we spill it upon the ground. Yet, behind us is that vast area of water booming endlessly upon the shore. The sound of memory is now to me like the sound of the tide, as when in the olden days I listened to it through the summer evenings. I want you to think of memory as this great sea. It gives of itself to the earth through all the seasons. It is, therefore, all about you as moisture is about you. Even when you are on earth, you may draw from this invisible memory almost unknowingly. And, as one country has a damper atmosphere, a heavier rainfall than another, so will one mentality draw to it a greater share of the collective memory than another. It is changed when filtered through the brain of man. It takes upon itself his color, his personality, and eventually it comes up to his consciousness as original thought, but horribly dull and unoriginal at times. For the average man draws through him mostly the recent memory ejected by many living brains. The thinker has a greater capacity for drawing to him the memories that lie in the depths of human nature, the strong memory, not the superficial one that is tossed off by the brain of man at the moment. What is rapidly cast off does not continue to live for any length of time. It is only the emotional memories, or the memories created by a fine vehemence, that permanently continue. Man is like a power station, constantly generating the fresh electric fluid of memory, constantly receiving, constantly giving out again. Human beings cling to their individualities, probably it is but fitting that they should do so. But only what is fundamentally themselves, what is the very kernel of their being, survives the continual dissolution. For, my friend, in life we are mentally perpetually dying. In other words, as in every third season the tree casts off its leaves, so do we, as the years go trooping by, continually cast off our memories. And in so doing we change very considerably. What a stranger the boy Tom Jones of 10 years old is to the man Tom Jones whose 60 years have sounded. How shy and self-conscious they would be if they met. How, in many respects, they would dislike each other. But, from far down, there would come some elusive stirring, some strange thrilling, deep calling to deep, if you will, so that these two, the boy aged 10 and the man aged 60, would, despite their superficial differences, be drawn to each other as surely as the magnet draws the iron. They would scarcely know why they thus responded, flew together despite their conscious incongruities, but they would inevitably respond, be thus drawn together. For something deeper than individual memory compels this unity. They share very few concrete memories, they are strangers. But the fine core of things has moved them to be comrades, friends. In like manner, when men and women journey into this new state of life they meet, perhaps after many years, wives, husbands, sons, daughters who have tarried 20 or 30 years behind them on the earth. If all is well, if they meet again in the world of the departed souls, they will not recognize each other through memory of facts. They will know each other through something that goes far deeper than that memory. Love and hate, caution and impetuosity, all the qualities that lie at the base of a man's or a woman's nature, will cause them to recognize each other, so that there is no need for reference, or for search in the book of life. The fundamental knowledge still remains, and the old ties may be renewed, that is, if they belong to the fundamental part of you. But please believe me, since I died I have not remained stationary. I have been changing, evolving, putting on, if you will, like the trees, a fresh coat of leaves, but unchanged within, so that my wife and my children will know me though some of my earth memories be buried as the foliage underground when winter comes. In stating that some of my earth memories are a closed book to me, I do not wish to indicate that they are cut off irretrievably from me. They do not, in my present state, assist me, for I am exceedingly occupied on the fourth plane in forging new impressions out of a fresh set of experiences in form. Be assured I shall, in the intermediate state between the fourth and fifth plane of being, review all those earth memories again. Footnote. The statements concerning discarnate beings contained in these two essays on memory apply to souls when they are living consciously on the fourth plane. Chapter 16, The Great Memory. The great memory is, if you will, the subconscious mind of the whole human race. In our life, As in yours, there is the consciousness, the self known to other discarnate beings who live in the same state as those akin to them fundamentally. But there is also a deeper self, which is the self of the world, imperishable as I believe, containing what was and is, containing also what shall be. For the history of man from the earliest to the latest times is all within what is sometimes called the tree of memory. You may say, but future events have not yet happened, so how can they have shaped themselves upon the ether? I tell you they have happened, for they have already been born in the imagination of God. But the future is difficult to read, I mean difficult for men to read, because the memory of the future has not been so deeply impressed upon the invisible timeless substance, in that it has been thought only once and not twice, thought by the maker of the universes. Therefore, it is very fine and faint, and only its echo is caught by certain mortals who have the inner hearing. Whereas the gross and clumsy subjective thinking of man causes past memories to be, from the point of view of the sensitive, more definitely shaped in the flowing energy. I want you to understand the significance of this vast memory in the lives of the ever-living, whom you may call departed souls. These, in pursuing their present existence, can live away from the memory of all past existence, or they can resume a vanished personality by picking up the threads from the great memory and sucking in from them, as you might suck a sugar cane, the nourishment of a past personality. It is not always perfectly shaped when the discarnate being endeavors to communicate. Sometimes only a little of the past individual's garment of mortality is taken from the great storehouse and, for a brief while, displayed. Now I would call your attention to an important point in this connection. We, you and I, are each recorded on some page in this great memory. We must, as players in a drama, relearn the old part before we endeavor to speak to our friends on earth, through a medium. As a rule, we neglect this task, or we succeed in obtaining only a glimpse of the memory that enshrines our vanished personality. We have vanished and we have not vanished. It is hard to explain this duality. Fundamentally, we are the same as we were when a loved wife, mother, or sister bade us goodbye in the earth life. We are the same in the sense that we should continue to have a feeling of repulsion for certain things and people we disliked on earth, and the old affections would flame up if we met again those people and things that were dear to us. But if by personality you mean the sum total of our earth memories, our knowledge of Greek and Latin, our knowledge of concrete facts, then we are indeed changed, in that we can, as a rule, only resuscitate the old knowledge by obtaining contact with that part of the great memory which is ours. Yet we do retain apart from it our old mentality, much of its idiosyncrasies. That part of ourselves that is no longer integral, that has become detached, is the fleeting physical consciousness of that period when we bade the earth farewell, is the aggregation of memory concerning facts in our earth life, concerning certain concrete knowledge memorized by us. Emotional memory remains an integral part of the soul, for it comes from the creative life. Chapter 17, Attention. For the incarnate and discarnate being, I will define attention. As you know it, in physiological terms, attention is the direction by the will of a certain nerve force into certain special cells of the brain. That is, suppose I want to recall the image of St. Mark's in Venice, I direct the nerve force into that special cell or cells connected with my memory of Venice. The entity created by Venetian experiences wakes into life, and becomes for a time a personality, while all the time, quite behind it, in the background, is the controlling will, but the Venetian self is expressing its personality during that period. I merely take Venice as an example. These centers of personality have been, I think, created usually by a network of far more complicated associations and memories. They have each of them been derived from a series of fundamental experiences that have cut deep into the soft material of the soul. Attention for the discarnate being, try and think of the mind as a web, in it are numerous centers about which radiate thoughts and memories. Any one of these centers can direct its attention towards the earth. We are all fundamentally one, but when we concentrate upon some special operation of thought we become divided. In order that we may become one again we have to travel far from you. We must be fused in the spirit again. I do not, by the word far, wish to indicate distance as you know it. I merely wish to indicate that the very fineness of our composition leads us, when we are one, to be remote from you. You possibly will not believe me when I tell you that each star has its own personality. It is one and yet it is many. In the same way you, even when in the body, are, in the same material sense, one yet many. There are myriads of little entities within you, but there is only one mind or one channel for the mind. The interesting feature of my state here is that I am within a larger mind which is not a collective one but is rounded off from many others. Many of my affinities are contained in it. All those phases in my earth life are represented by these various centers. I have spoken to you of attention in a physiological sense. I have described it as a stream of nervous energy, being directed towards certain cells or a certain cell in the brain, these being connected with certain images. Very well. As we are now constituted, we have no material brain, but we possess a certain psychic web. This web is not exactly on the plan of the brain. It does not contain millions of tiny neurons or compartments, but it contains several centers which can draw or attract a stream of psychic energy from the unifying principle. If a great effort is made, there can be attention in more than one direction, but not always. It is possible when we are communicating with the world that we can only supply one center or focus at a time with this active stream or motive force. This is quite easy to understand, for a considerable effort of concentration is required when we manipulate another deeper mind. Sometimes we succeed in communicating with two people at once, but it is exceedingly difficult. The interesting point for you in connection with these centers or halfway houses is that the memory of what we have communicated is lodged therein, or rather it is in touch with that center and no other center with that focus, and also with the unifying principle, which, as you know, contains many in one. Chapter 18, The Subliminal Self. I promised to speak to you about the inner content of mind. I think, perhaps, I had better commence by speaking of man as a living organism. That seems a curious idea to me now, but I must use your terms as you understand them. To begin with, scientists have not in the least realized how very detached consciousness or the soul is from the body. The latter is the inheritance received from many past generations. It is in itself an empire, polyzoic and even polypsychic. It is, in fact, infinitely more complicated, with 3 degrees of nerves, those of the higher centers, those of the middle and lower. These nerves are the keys upon which our consciousness plays. Now, I want you to understand that we, in our etheric condition, to a certain degree correspond with the physical organism. Have you ever pondered over that mysterious phrase, "In the beginning the image was made flesh"? I may quote incorrectly, but that phrase, or one that is similar to it, which you will find in the Bible, contains a vast truth. The living organism is, to a certain degree, a reflection of what is in the unseen. There is a unifying principle of which I have already told you. There are also minor consciousnesses which I have already spoken of as centers, or as the focus. When I communicate with the earth, one of these minor consciousnesses, or psychic entities, takes possession of the medium, supplanting one of the psychic entities which she possesses. We never supplant what I call the unifying principle in her. If we did, she would go mad. It is a very difficult feat, and is only attempted by certain malevolent entities on this side. Now, can you imagine a country, take England for example, dotted over with towns all self-contained, yet looking to that vast city London for general directions and for a certain essential stimulus? Such is the condition of the discarnate being. He is a kingdom, bounded by what would seem to have the appearance of a veil. It has a curious elasticity. I mean, we differ from the kingdom to which I have alluded in that we can alter at will the shape of this very subtle material or fluid. We differ in many other respects. Our surroundings are of a metetheric character. You may ask me to define this. It is exceedingly difficult. But I think I may say that it contains atoms of the very finest kind. They pass through your coarser matter. They belong to another state altogether. You may then ask, how does your world or state differ from our earth? It differs very considerably, for the reason that this fluid is quite unformed. After death, if we are sufficiently developed, We enter into our subliminal self. When we were alive, we believed that there were two forms of consciousness, one the inner mind, the other the supraliminal, that which was above the threshold, that which controlled our ordinary business, that which appeared to direct operations generally. We looked on the subliminal as being that which was below the threshold, the inner mind, the inspired part of our nature, the creative source. Very well then, since I have passed over, I have come to realize that actually, in the sense of pure mind, there is no supraliminal part. There is in its stead an infinitely complicated machine which has become more and more subtilized through the centuries, so that now it responds to the slightest of vibrations, sent out by the subliminal, or what you may perhaps call the subconscious, mind. Of what, then, does the supraliminal or ordinary consciousness consist? Of a very wonderful nerve memory, of all the physical desires of the body, to a large extent controlled by that nerve memory, and lastly, and most important, of the reflection of the subliminal part of you. Usually, the subliminal sends its reflection, which, to a faint or a powerful degree, is received by the fluid shape which I call the nerve memory. This, in its turn, transmits the reflection in vibrations to the brain. Normal consciousness is to a certain degree threefold. It consists in the main of the image interpreted by the nerve memory, and of the material part, the brain, which is responsive to the image sent by this inner mind. But that is not by any means all. The brain and body, as a rule, must set the desire for the image in motion before the latter can be dispatched and made perceptible. In short, the body must be receptive, or, rather, the nerves and brain must receive and register. These to alter and elaborate, or they simplify and give color to, the contribution that has come from the higher portion of man's nature. There is also a reverse process, the assimilation of impressions of the material world by the brain, which are transferred to the higher centers and returned in due course. There is, in short, a constant trafficking during the individual's waking hours between these various parts of his being. Many points still require elucidation. You probably desire to know where is that positive, and very frequently objectionable, entity, the ego. It is a sum in arithmetic, a figure worthy of the attention of mathematicians. It is really the sum total of the physical needs of man, and the accretions through many generations of inherited memories, added to his innate capacity for corresponding with the inner mind and for receiving its image. Now there are times of creative activity which scholars have been kind enough to allocate to the inner mind. Then great works are produced, and you cannot understand the mystery of their creation. They are produced through a certain singular aptitude on the part of the brain, which responds to the message from the inner mind directing the nerve memory. The fluid shape does not act as a medium, and there is in consequence no blurred interpretation. Added to this, of course, must be a considerable store of knowledge, or images, all connected with the brain cells by those invisible threads of which I have already spoken. You must realize that the act of creation, then, is collaboration. The stream of energy from the inner mind molds the work of art, partly out of these associations, these memories, but also partly out of the harvest of floating thoughts, from which it can draw more directly when the fluid shape is not the actual medium. In the case of the normal consciousness, the fluid shape plays an important part and is largely the ego. It will very frequently draw from the psychic entities, the minor consciousnesses, but these usually are directly bound up with the unifying principle, they are merely its tributaries. When there is a disintegration of personality, it is sometimes due to one of these entities losing touch with the unifying principle, owing to the possible misbehavior of the fluid shape or nerve memory, which sends out a too powerful appeal to this psychic entity. The central consciousness, however, is usually, if directly evoked, able to obtain control again. I want you, in the light of my remarks, to consider and study the evolution of man. The larger mind has been there, in a state at times unformed, from the dark ages, from the beginning, if there ever was a beginning, which I doubt. At first this mind found it could only at times send faint reflections to primitive people, whom it had gradually evolved, created as a sculptor creates. But in time the form of man developed, and was the more easily able to receive the image. the Word was made flesh with greater and greater facility. You may ask, in connection with mind, why it thus sought to express itself. It desired individuality, it, too, desired form, and form and individuality were, to a certain degree, achieved through this constant interchange between mind and matter. But, mark you, it is still the essence of matter, the nerves and nerve memory, that dominates and controls the actions of the human being. So seek for the normal ego, when you are a living woman, in the nerve soul, in the construction of the brain and body, and in the image sent by the unifying principle. The Word was made flesh. In that phrase you may find the whole mystery of man's nature, the sum total of his being. You desire to know what is ordinary consciousness. The actual constructive force is, in its essence, the nerve soul, but ordinary consciousness is a sum in arithmetic. The needs of the body, the cravings of the mechanisms, are all influencing the nerve soul in its decisions. What you call the subconscious is the reflection, the light from above. Sometimes it is feeble because the summons is weak. It also plays a part in the decision. Time, of course, is a factor that puzzles you in this connection, but the whole organization is through centuries of evolution, so subtleized that it can make its decision rapidly. In the days of primitive man, the I, the constructive force, the ego, was principally the body, the nerves, the fluid shape even were subordinate. I want you to understand that there are not, save in very rare cases, two wills making decisions at the same time consciously. There is only one, because there is only one channel, but the subliminal self, which is outside the larger mind if you prefer the term, is exceedingly active, and, when messages in daytime are sent to it through the channel, that is to say, via the nerve soul, then this mind works upon the message and sends it during sleep, in a new guise, back to the nerve soul, which it can easily do, because the soul is apart from the body, quite still, and yet able to reflect the desired image which it craved for in waking hours. This is, on waking, attached by it to the brain cells, and you find some problem solved for you as by a magician when you are roused again out of sleep. Initiative during the day, then, comes from the nerve soul, fed by the image or the reflection from the subliminal, and influenced always by the body and its desires. Chapter 19, Sleep. I want you to understand that I have not by any means explored the possibilities of the subliminal self in that little essay of mine. Please regard it merely as a preliminary canter. I have been puzzled as to the treatment of it. When I was a dead man, that is to say when I was alive on earth, I believed that sleep was simply a withdrawal of the spirit, an emptying of the chambers of the brain and a search for refreshment in another world, or, rather, that there was a replenishing of spiritual energy, a kind of irrigation, and that from it there came that freshness, that sense of invigoration, which we have all experienced on waking to a new day. I believed firmly in a life passed into worlds, and in this I was perfectly right. I was puzzled as to the exact conditions obtained during slumber. Now I am more sensible of them. Actually, the nerve soul is detached from the body when you are in the state you call sleep. That means there is no direct interpreter, or medium, between the spirit and the brain cells. This is important. The body, as I have previously stated, is largely dominated by this nerve soul. It becomes almost quiescent when the latter is withdrawn into a metetheric atmosphere. The nerve soul is bathed in this atmosphere, and receives a very necessary stimulus, or rather nourishment, from what I believe you now call ether. But ether is a broad term, and it is in reality a subdivision of ether that feeds the nerve soul during sleep. Perhaps I should coin a new word and call it etheric essence. I feel I am most audacious in thus infringing on the rights of physicists, who alone should christen the elements both visible and invisible. Now, while the nerve soul is absent, the spirit is still close to the body. It cannot send the image as I have termed it directly to the brain. It makes no effort to do so usually, but there are occasions when the higher nerve centers are in a particularly susceptible state. Then the spirit may endeavor to cast upon it some image, or rather to direct one, through invoking a residuum of power that has been left behind by the nerve soul. Then your sleeper will dream, perhaps, of some future event, or will image some violent death that is taking place elsewhere. The spirit draws within it the reflection of certain emotional affinities of the being who is slumbering, and it thus succeeds on rare occasions in casting an image of the future, or of some present happening, upon the quiescent brain.